So I should probably introduce myself
yes,
to you
yes.
since I
you don't have to,
we've never met before.
No,
I don't
we
think.
Haven't.
My name is Marcus de Sotoy, and I'm a professor of mathematics in Oxford.
And my name is Bonnie Greer, and I'm a playwright.
Right.
And well, okay, now I got to do the gush. And then
well, I don't know, actually. I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay, let me just do the prelude first, I got to do. First of all, that book's for you, but I'm going to write.
All right,
okay.
Oh, I'm talking about entropy with my son this morning.
Okay,
actually.
Tell you. Let me speak to you, man.
Okay,
everybody sit down, because I got to say this. Okay. Sorry about that. That's my American part. Okay. I was working on that book in May 2005. I wanted to say this to Mark, but didn't get a chance. Just trying to make this book work. So then I turned on the BBC, The Horizon, and there was Andrew Wiley, and there was a bunch of numbers on the board, and he was like this, and I had my pages there, and I looked up at that board, and I burst into tears. I think I cried all day. And when they talked to him
Beauty of it all?
I did, yes.
Yeah, good, that's right.
But this is the spooky part.
Not
this
what
is,
most people cry
no,
about
no,
mathematics.
No, but Marcus, what I want to say is that was something I had lost. And because I love numbers. And I didn't know what was up there, but I knew what he was doing. And I knew how he found the solution. I can't tell you mathematically how he found it, but I knew what he did. So for the next 8 months, I went out and bought every popular mathematic book I could find. I was reading them three at a time. Then one day I saw you on television, and you were in some, like, going up some stairs in Las Vegas. And
oh,
I
yes,
thought...
Sir.
There's
a story behind
this,
that one.
Right.
Yeah, there's a story behind that one.
Well, let me tell you what happened. And I thought, So, you know, and I got these three mathematical books in front of me. One on Fermat, Simon Singh. I've got a book on the uncertainty principle. I've got a book on the uncertainty principle, Simon Singh, and Alan Turing. And so these, like, spread out in our house. And then you're coming up on this Las Vegas stairwell, you know, stuff. And I'm going, like, what's this? And then you explained the zeros and the critical line. And I just thought, I got to meet this guy someday. So this book is dedicated to you, by the way. Because I...
Gosh.
No, seriously. No. I'm serious because... I thought you brought something back to me that I had lost. And so I just want to say thank you for
that.
Oh,
yes, that's so sweet
thank
of you.
Thank you,
yeah,
thank
well,
you.
I mean, it's interesting you had that emotional reaction to the maths because I don't know whether you remember, but that Horizon program starts off with Andrew Wiles talking about his solution. And he's just remembering that moment. I mean, although Mark mentioned that, you know, it's a lot of hard work which goes into those breakthroughs. But in mathematics, quite often they do come in a rush and that aha moment. And certainly Alan Turing, he talked about that when he was running along the banks of the River Cam. He stopped for a moment, was lay down, and then suddenly had this flash which allowed him to solve the problem that he was working on. But Andrew Wiles then suddenly remembers that moment and he starts crying. He just, it's such an emotional moment for him when he recalls that breakthrough, that rush of adrenaline that he had. You know, and it's a beautiful moment. I mean, it makes the whole film because, you know, he starts crying and then he does like that to the camera.
Yes, and tells him to go away.
Yeah. And I think that's the unexpected thing, I think, for people when they encounter mathematics. They do not realize it's an incredibly emotional aesthetic, passionate subject.
Absolutely.
And that's why, you know, it's a hard subject as
Absolutely.
Well. And I've had maybe three of those aha moments in my whole life, but they are such a drug.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about, you know, you work for 8 years and then it's you have to be ready for when it comes.
Yes.
It's such a drug that that's, you want to repeat it.
It is, it is. And I just feel, I mean, in the novel, there's a little boy. I mean, this novel is about three black women, and one of them has a son who is a mathematical genius, and the argument is about whether he stays in the community or whether he goes away to advance his mathematics. And he's running away from some guys because he goes to the library, and he's running. And he comes home, and his mother is just freaked out, and he says, "No, I just came up with a solution while I'm running. I just, this problem I'm working on, I understand now what these guys are doing and what it is. It is the entropy that was released within what happens in oppression. There is a certain amount of entropy that is given off in slavery or in any kind of situation, and that these people have somehow used it. And I know that's not possible, but that's why I call it that. That's the theory.
Right. Have you read about the story of Ramanujan and Hardy?
I Kerala is the only place I really want to go in India,
to tell you the truth. It's fantastic.
Yes, exactly.
I just did this series. You said you studied history. I did a series for the BBC about the history of mathematics.
Yes, I've got it.
Oh, right, okay.
Of course I do.
I mean, actually, I think that's... a lot of schools are now showing that.
It's good,
because I think it just brings alive where mathematics isn't a closed, finished subject.
Right, that's right.
One of the most exciting discoveries in the whole of that making of that series was going to Kerala. Because, okay, I knew that the Indians had discovered zero, and they were responsible for the Hindu-Arabic numerals and things. But what I didn't realize, that there was this school of mathematicians in Kerala around, I think, 11th to the 13th century, who essentially discovered calculus before Newton and Leibniz did. Mm. They had, in university, I learned this formula called the Leibniz series, which is a formula for... pi over 4.
Mm-hmm.
Pi over 4 is equal to 1 minus a third plus a fifth minus a seventh plus a ninth. You just go on, add all of these up. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, lovely pattern in pi. This is actually already in the work of the Keralean mathematician several centuries before Leibniz.
Mm-hmm.
So that program is program 2 in the whole series. It's really exciting because it opened up this sort of myth that maths finished with the ancient Greek civilization,
and then we
had to wait till medieval time in Europe.
Exactly.
And, no, there was a huge amount going
on. It's that idea of when human beings make a big leap that is a mutating leap in either being able to realize that the thumb is actually something that's going to make technology, in fact. They say that there's a leap that happens in all of human beings, and that, in fact, the fact that we don't know that it's happened... we in the West, doesn't mean it hasn't happened. And so, as you say, Kerala is an example of this incredible mathematical tradition being carried on as part of the human tradition, but suddenly it comes to light for us with this lovely guy who contacts a teacher at Oxford, at
Cambridge, with
all these beautiful problems that he has.
Yeah.
And
but I think it's a very good example of in relation to your book about should you take somebody out of their culture in order to benefit their mathematics, because he went through this big dilemma. He was a Brahmin, which meant that he wasn't allowed to leave India.
That's right.
His whole culture, but he was so lonely mathematically.
Yes,
he needed something, and eventually his family goddess Namagiri visits him in a dream and says, "No, you can cross
that's
the
right,
water."
That's right.
And but it, you know, he's although
but,
mathematically
but,
he's not lonely. You know, emotionally he was very lonely here.
But as you say, he came over and he couldn't wear he had the wrong shoes and he couldn't eat the food. And then, who's the mathematician who got frightened of who became anorexic and died? The great one, was that the one who discovered the
Gödel?
The great Gödel.
Very paranoid.
Yes.
He thought people were trying to poison him.
Yes.
But,
and it was you actually who. Said the inconsistency principle that no system can be both
Yes, incompleteness theory.
Yeah,
Gödel's incompleteness theory.
Yes, and no system can be both consistent and complete, which is very beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is. I think a lot of artists have picked up on this idea, because what it says is that within any system which doesn't have contradictions, there will for numbers there will always be true statements which you cannot prove. Which is kind of
it's beautiful.
Yeah, but it's a little bit worrying. You might be working on one of those, and you can't prove it within your system.
But it's something that says something courageous about the human spirit. Because if we are working on something that is a possibility, as Andrew Weil says about Fermat, we didn't have the mathematics for it, so there's no way that it was proven because the maths didn't exist, and that there's a possibility that you could be working on a problem, but there is the maths. We don't have the maths.
No, exactly. And one of the books, I think, which illustrates this rather nicely is Doxiadis' novel. Have you read that?
No.
Uncle Petros and the Goldbach Conjecture, about a Greek mathematician. And he's working at the time of Turing and Hardy, and he's working on the Goldbach Conjecture, that every even number can be written as the sum of two prime numbers. Mm. Now, we haven't been able to prove this yet. So simple a statement. And suddenly this discovery of Gödel's, that there are true statements which cannot be proved, comes out. And he's totally unsettled. He thinks, maybe I'm working on one of those. Maybe I'm going to spend my whole life working on something which is true, but I can never prove. So it's actually, Doxy, I'll just give a little plug. Hold on a minute.
And tell me about what you were saying about entropy as well. You said you were talking to your little boy about it.
My bedtime reading at the moment, you might like this, is a comic novel by Doxiadis. It's called Logicomics.
Gosh, I'd like to read
it's
that.
It's so fantastic. It's so beautiful.
That.
But it's all about Gödel and the very unsettling principle that he introduced. I mean, it did cause a lot of mathematicians to kind of feel rather uneasy, because I think the ancient Greeks, you know, the ethos of the mathematics is, if something's true, you should be able to prove it. And then
but you know what? Something before we disappear, Marcus, because we can. You know what I mean? It's like, I think that the beauty of mathematics, I mean, it is utterly and completely beautiful. But the beauty of mathematics is, I thank you for, and others like you, for being able to bring it to people like me, who couldn't possibly look at an equation and understand these shapes, but you've made it possible. I mean, when people complain about Stephen Hawking's original book, I think to myself, how in the world could that guy write it? So, I mean, the genius of being able to write it. So actually, you could read what his mind is amazing.
No, I think that people listen to pieces of music. I mean, if you go upstairs and listen to what's going on.
You got to tell us about that, about the intervals.
Yeah, well, exactly. Okay. Well, the whole point is you don't necessarily need to understand exactly how it's put it together to get a lot emotionally out of it. And, you know, how many pieces of music do you really understand how they composed it?
Exactly.
Or, you know, so often I think mathematics, we sort of demand, I think it comes back to school, that everyone understands everything. And that's, you don't have to. You can get a sense of what's going on, and then that might inspire you to go deeper. But I think there is this impression that, you know, I have to understand. I mean, it's great that people feel they need to have to understand everything.
Yes.
But I think the art in writing these kind of books, popular maths books, all the things on the telly, is to give people a sense of the drama, the movement of ideas, and not all of the details. Because as you say, it takes a long time. You can't learn a musical instrument in a day, but you can appreciate somebody playing.
Exactly. Or you can be born with a mathematical mind, or you don't have a mathematical mind, which doesn't mean that you can't do mathematics.
No.
I mean,
I would like to say that we are all born with mathematics.
Yes, I agree with that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And it is about being able to recognize pattern and understand that everything is a pattern. And when you were able to sort of break that down so that I could actually pick it up, I was able to actually do a lot of things, because I was able to see, you know, solve problems, because I could see the pattern.
Yeah.
And you could see how the patterns were taking shape.
And I think that's the point. In very many artistic disciplines, you see that it is about looking for interesting structures and patterns. That's why I think there's a lot of... I mean, I have a lot of collaborations with different artists, and I always find that actually they're interested in the same sort of structures
Absolutely. That
I'm working on.
Absolutely. And also I think that the whole system, if you look at even Shakespeare, you can see the mathematics in Shakespeare, you can see the pattern in Shakespeare, you can see the repetition, you can see the coming back.
And actually, and I can see in Jem's notes, if you look on the website, there are some prime numbers written, and mm-hmm. He clearly was playing around, because the person who did come up with a very clever way to do this was Messiaen.
Yes.
Olivier Messiaen in the Quartet for the End of Time. Mm-hmm. He wanted to create mm-hmm. in the first movement, Liturgy de Crystal, mm-hmm. this sense of timelessness. Mm-hmm. And what he did is a very clever trick to use prime numbers to do it. Mm-hmm. So he has in the piano, I mean, it's a quartet, but the piano is where the magic mm-hmm. is happening. Mm-hmm. He has a rhythm sequence which repeats itself after 17 different notes. Mm-hmm. And the melodic sequence mm-hmm. repeats itself after 29 mm-hmm. notes. So after he's done the rhythm 17 notes, mm-hmm. the melody is still going on. Mm-hmm. And when the melody is finished, he's a little bit way through the rhythm section again. Mm-hmm. So when do these first match up again? Mm-hmm. You have to hear the rhythm and the melody 17 times 29 times. Mm-hmm. Which is a large number. You never get to that mm-hmm. in the piece. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it repeats itself. Mm-hmm. So you can see Jem in his notes actually playing around with prime numbers to see how many primes he needs in order to get beyond 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And that's his first idea, I think, mm-hmm. was to use this idea of messiness. Mm-hmm. But ultimately what is happening is that he's chosen the amount that you have to sort of shift back. It's like a record player, so you mm-hmm. shift it back to a certain point in the music mm-hmm. and it starts playing mm-hmm. from then. Now, one of the tracks, you have to do this shifting mm-hmm. So many times it only hits the mm-hmm. position you started mm-hmm. at after 1,000 years.
That's right.
Now, for me, that's slightly dissatisfying, because the six tracks have the idea that you could have used primes to sort of keep them mm-hmm. sort of out of sync mm-hmm. until they all matched up. But actually, only one of those tracks is needed to do the repetition for 1,000 years.
So he's got all of he's got a workshop up there as opposed to sort of the kind of... tell me about... Because in the novel, I have one of the ways that this young girl gets to understand who her mother is. Her mother was a mathematician. Mm. Is that her mother used the Sophie Germain
primes.
Which I find very beautiful as well. And we don't hear a lot about her. And I mean, she should have her name should be on the Eiffel Tower, actually. And there are a lot of names there, but her name isn't there.
Yeah, yes. I mean, this is, it's interesting what Mark said earlier about that there aren't many women doing engineering, I think, at King's, because that's not true for mathematics.
That's right.
In Oxford, we have about 50% of the students are doing maths, are women. And that's fantastic. I think there really has been a sea change. And it's interesting how culturally that varies as well, because in France and in Italy, it's always been quite a lot of women in mathematics. You go to a mathematics conference in Italy, there are a lot of women doing it. And I think the trouble still is translating that, you know, a lot of good women doing mathematics at undergraduate level, that still hasn't quite gone through to
and
faculty.
And why is that not?
Because
in my generation, we were literally stopped.
Mm.
And possibly that was because maybe they knew there wasn't any place for you. There wasn't any, you're not going to go on to MIT or Princeton. It's not going to happen because of the politics or whatever.
Well,
so
I think
you
need role models. And we have got, good, you know, in Oxford, we've got several really brilliant women who are FRSs, Fellows of the Royal Society. And I think they show you, well, there's nothing different between a male and a female brain when you're doing mathematics. This is just total myth, unlike the guy at Harvard who
yes.
sort of said, you know, it's a total myth.
Yes, Feynman, yes.
Exactly.
Yes, only men can do
math. So I think it is, things are changing. But Sophie Germain is interesting because this History of Mathematics series I did, you know, we got to the 20th century and we kind of went, oh my gosh, we haven't had any women? Well, actually, we'd had Hypatia. We put Hypatia, but I wouldn't actually rank her as a fantastic mathematician. I mean, she's an interesting character. But Sophie Germain, of course, had to pretend to
be a man
to be listened to.
Yes.
And she wrote to Carl Friedrich Gauss under the name Monsieur Leblanc.
Yes,
you know, it was the only way that she could be taken seriously.
Yeah, yes, so, exactly. To be But she has a number. She's recognized in mathematics.
Yes, yes. And related comes back to where we started, to Fermat's Last Theorem, because yes. She was working on Fermat's Last Theorem and realized that equations where x to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n, where n is one of these special primes called a Germain prime, that there was a way to solve these. So
what happens to a mathematician when he hits a wall like Einstein did with Gödel, when, you know, the whole thing was blown out of the water?
When you hit a wall is different.
It's blown out of the water. In the sense that didn't Einstein say God doesn't play dice with the universe? And Gödel says, but you can't know any of this ultimately. We can just keep playing in this field, and maybe we'll find something to get a little step closer. But
yeah, well, I think there are two different things. I think the Gödel one is the one I can probably say something more interestingly about, which is I think that most mathematicians just stuck their head back in the sand and said, okay, well, there's this rather unsettling theorem, but I'm going to carry on working on what I do because mathematics does seem consistent. It doesn't seem to throw up contradictions. And I think the extraordinary thing is that although you have these incredibly difficult things like Fermat's Last Theorem, that after 350 years we have come up with a way to find a solution. I mean, I find that utterly stunning that the human mind, it's finite in nature, but it can conceive of infinity. You know, Euclid proved there are infinitely many primes, yet with just a little finite argument. That's extraordinary. I love the fact that mathematics can help you to touch the infinite.
So what is it in us as a species where we see something like a Gödel? We see this, we know that this is true, in the sense that we know that this man is speaking the truth.
Yes.
Yet people say, I can't deal with it. I'm going to go on and do my thing.
I don't know. I think they did deal with it. I mean, the great thing about mathematics is that once something is proved, there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to accept the way it is. I mean, one of our big obsessions at the moment is the Riemann hypothesis. Are the zeros on the critical line, are the primes laid out in the way we believe they are? If it turns out to be false, you know, that means that mathematics isn't as beautiful as we think it is, but we just have to move on. It's not a hypothesis then, it'll be proved. I think mathematics is very different to physics and the other sciences. In the other sciences, you put up a hypothesis, you put a lot of evidence, but it's very difficult to prove categorically that it's true. And you see that because in generations we'll show that the theory has faults to it and it has to be reworked. Newtonian physics isn't quite right. It won't explain everything. So you have to come up with relativistic physics. So it's a more evolutionary process to doing science. Whilst mathematics, it's everything. As Newton said, we truly build on the shoulders of giants. What is proved 2,000 years ago by the Greeks is as true today as it was 2,000 years ago. And that's something I find very... I like that security of mathematics.
Yes, yes. And I like that beauty as well.
Yeah,
This brain existed then, that it was able to do that.
And it gives a sense of immortality. I mean, Hardy wrote about this. You know, mathematics is a one-shot thing. Euclid's name will live forever because of that proof he gave of there being infinitely many primes.
So have you ever thought mathematically why there are crashes in October and September?
That's a leap. Well, I think that mathematics is a sort of subject which we'll be able to understand whether there is a pattern to there being more crashes. I mean, do you have a theory?
Well, there is a mathematics about volcanoes, isn't there? That we are expecting that Vesuvius is overdue, for instance, and we know somehow that it's
mathematics is the best thing we have to predict the future, because we can spot patterns in the past and pick them up again. And so if you're looking for a tsunami or an earthquake, they're difficult patterns, and that's why we're not good enough at it. And they're also, I mean, the other interesting topic is chaos theory, which we've understood that certain mathematics is so sensitive to little changes that it is incredibly difficult to get enough data to ultimately predict the weather.
So are we talking about this in relation to chaos? We don't know the initial conditions for this sort of pattern of October, September, something happens.
Possibly, but if it is, I mean, I think that's the trouble with things like earthquakes, that it can be a very small change. Mm-hmm. The whole system is pretty deterministic, but we just cannot know enough detail to be able to say, are we in this zone or this zone? Is it going to go or is it not? So.
Well, when you talk about chaos, I mean, one of my theories is that we have a kind of epidemic right now in say, the community, the Black community to a certain extent, and with males. There seems to be an epidemic of suddenly, on a certain level, a sort of crime, kind of crime happened. And one of my theories is that there is an initial condition that sociologists are not trained to look at, that in fact these kids, and I mean not just Black kids, but urban kids, are playing back their system that's playing back a kind of map of what is going on in their environment, mm-hmm. and that they are in fact the end result of something. So instead of looking at these children, these kids as a problem, we need to look at what's going on, an initial condition within their environment. I think it has to do with the fact that London is a fractal and that there's an enormous amount of sort of people on top of one another. There isn't a lot of space, and so people are reacting to mm-hmm. to rat-like kind of environments, and it causes violence.
Yes, also, and it's there's a subject called catastrophe theory, which is not so talked about these days, but that's how it shows sort of how societies and different situations that it can sometimes require just a small push. Again, it's chaos kind of theory that a small push might send a stable community into a sort of warfare environment.
So
it is it's very you're absolutely right. You mustn't just look at the result, you have to look at the whole structure.
Exactly.
If you're ever going to understand anything.
And that goes back to my theory about I wish scientists and mathematicians were more involved in these situations, because instead of looking at the top layer, you know, guys walking down streets with knives, it's better to look at the initial conditions and to see these guys with knives as kind of messengers of something that needs to be looked at back here.
Yeah,
and
I thought it was very optimistic of you that if we stuck mathematicians in the government and journalists, that we might have things sorted out.
They can't hurt.
Well, I mean, I think there is a a lot of sort of economics and things is about game theory, and it is about understanding the system. So I think there is a... I do want to make one little confession to you, which is admission that if I wasn't a mathematician, what I wanted to do was work in the theatre.
You are in the theatre.
Well, in some sense,
but
it
you
is
know
about,
you are in the theatre.
Yeah,
I mean, but you know you are in the theatre. What were you going to ask me? Because you came up to that you wanted.
Oh, I wondered why the number 3 was your favourite number.
Because I can hear it.
Uh huh.
Okay. It has a sound.
Right. What sort of sound? That's interesting.
It's a...
Especially in relation to...
Okay. It sounds... it has a kind of oriental tinkly sound. It's also gold, but a very sort of young gold. Mm-hmm. It's a very beautiful, which is why I love the Fibonacci sequence. The Fibonacci sequence, to me, visually, is very beautiful and very musical and has a lot of...
And do you know who discovered the Fibonacci sequence?
Well,
not
for
Fibonacci.
Fibonacci, who?
An Indian mathematician.
That makes sense.
Who was a poet.
Makes sense.
Actually. And a musician. And what he was trying to do was to count how many different rhythms there are.
Makes sense.
And so he was interested in long and short beats. If you've got long and short beats, how many rhythms can you make? So suppose you've got 4 beats in the bar. How many rhythms are there? Well, I can do 4 short beats, or I could do 2 long beats, or I could do long, short, short, or short, long, short, or short, short, long. And there I've got 5 different rhythms. That's one of the numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. Now if I have 5 beats in the bar, what's the next number? It's 8.
8.
The Fibonacci sequence again. 6 beats in the bar. And so he realized it was this beautiful pattern that to get the number of rhythms, you just add the 2 previous numbers that you've got for the rhythms, and that tells you how these rhythm structures evolve.
And to tell you that you are in the theater, because only a person of the theater could actually create the language and the narrative that you've been able to do in order to bring mathematics to lay people like myself, and that's totally about the theater. Otherwise, I again, to go back to Hawking and the person like yourself, to be able to take an equation, and an enormously complex equation, which is a language,
Yes, certainly. Yeah.
And to be able to take that language, which you and Hawking are able to do, and to translate it to another system whereby a person like me can actually take it in and go, I got it. I can't read this, but I got what you're saying, so that I can have enough knowledge and enough pleasure and enough respect for what you are doing so that I know what's going on. I can look at signs, I can look at sequence, I can look at patterns, I can know what a prime is. I can understand on a certain level why, if the Riemann hypothesis is finally proven, as you said, the banking system will go completely sky high. The whole thing will be,
we have to go to another level. Yeah, might be
talking about that in the next
conversation. Oh, right. I mean, I think that actually science is about performance. I mean, because my other job is as the professor for the public understanding of science. I followed on from Richard Dawkins in Oxford, and I think that for me, it's very important these two things. You can make mathematical discoveries, but unless you tell somebody else about them, they don't live. They just stay sterile, and so a lot of what we do is going to seminars, telling our stories. I mean, I always feel a little bit like a nomadic tribe that we sort of gather in these conferences around the world, and we tell each other our stories, and then we disband again. But it's the telling of the story, whether it's in a journal, in a proof, or in a seminar, that is the performance of the ideas.
Exactly.
And it is drama.
But for every mathematician like you, there are 9 of them who are like sitting in a corner, sort of.
Your proportions are probably.
And in the clothes they've worn for years, and they can't get it through.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I really am very grateful personally.
Yeah.
For you being
well,
able to do this.
Yeah. No. I mean, but I enjoy. I mean, I enjoy my mathematics, and that's why if I can share it, then that's great.
You have done so.
I don't know whether did you manage to get to see Complicité's show, The Disappearing Number?
Because, you know what? I didn't want to go.
Let me
explain, because I love Harding and
Ramanujan
so much.
Yeah. You were frightened.
I didn't want to see it because I thought, I'm sure it was brilliant, but I didn't want to see it on the stage.
Uh-huh, that's interesting.
And I can't explain that anymore.
Well, because I worked with Complicité for 2 years on the... it was sort of my... No, that's
right,
fine.
Right.
You didn't see it.
I just didn't.
No, but I think we went through the whole... I worked with Simon McBurney sort of trying to bring the mat alive. And I think he had the same feeling. He thought it was such a wonderful story. How do you... You can't just simply replicate it on the stage, that would belittle it. And so I think he was really working... What he wanted to do was to thread the mathematics into the structure of the play. I mean, I think one person who did that so successfully, getting the science in the structure of the play, was Michael Frayn with Copenhagen.
Yes.
I don't know whether you like that play or not, but I think that's so many plays about science are actually about the scientists, and the science is doesn't
they can't
come
deal
through.
With the science.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
you
but
can't
this,
deal with the science.
Copenhagen is exactly about the science. It's about, you know, how can you know if you observe something, it changes.
Yes.
They revisit this meeting
between
Bohr and Heisenberg.
Yes.
And every time it's different. And that's, you know, it is an example
of the theory itself.
Yeah, and Simon Burney wanted to do that with Disappearing Number. He didn't want it to be about Hardy and Ramanujan, who are such fantastic characters. For you know, you almost don't have to try hard to for the story to be great. But he said, no, I want to talk about their mathematics. And he was driving me to explain the maths. So, you know, he said, what is a mock theta function? And I said, I don't know. And I spent ages trying to decode for him what a mock theta function is.
And were you satisfied?
I don't think Simon was satisfied, actually.
What about you?
I think it was, I thought it was very good. But I think that there's still work to be done on it.